standards of academic excellence. More information and a schedule of upcoming public lectures are available at www.law.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, featuring foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, cheeses, gift baskets, along with party catering. Also through the holidays, daily food tastings with an expanded tasting on Saturdays. World Harvest Foods, located at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. On the program today, the story of the XX, that is, the United States Exploring Expedition. The four-year-long expedition circumnavigated the globe. It began in 1838 and involved six vessels and 346 men. Their charge? Explore the Pacific. Our guest this afternoon is Nathaniel Philbrick. His new book is about the XX. The book is Sea of Glory, America's Voyage of Discovery, the U.S. Exploring Expedition, 1838 to 1842. Philbrick reports that over the course of the expedition, 87,000 miles were logged, 280 Pacific islands were surveyed, and 180 charts were created. Some of those were still in use during the Second World War. In addition, 800 miles of the coastline of the Pacific Northwest were mapped, and 1,500 miles of the coast of Antarctica were mapped. Philbrick says these accomplishments taken together represent a national achievement on the order of building the Transcontinental Railroad and the Panama Canal. So why don't we remember the XX? One reason could be the character of the expedition's leader. Philbrick says Charles Wilkes was a troubled man. He was egotistical, cowardly, cruel, incredibly self-destructive. At the end of the expedition, he faced court-martial for a number of crimes, including a massacre of the inhabitants of an island in the South Pacific. Nathaniel Philbrick won the National Book Award for In the Heart of the Sea. He is director of the Egan Institute of Maritime Studies and a leading authority on the history of Nantucket. His new book, Sea of Glory, is published by Viking. Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's great to be with you, Celeste.
At the outset of this story, Sea of Glory, you say America's first frontier was not the West, it was the sea. Why then did the Lewis and Clark expedition precede an expedition to explore the seas?
Yeah, that's a great question. The one, you know, we as a country see ourselves as defined by our open spaces, by this notion of a wilderness and the frontier. And the fact of the matter is, in the beginning of the country's history, it was the Atlantic Ocean that was the defining moment of anyone coming to this country. And the Lewis and Clark expedition, yes, it led us to see what potential there was out in the West, but what a lot of people don't realize, it was called a voyage of discovery because it was out to find a waterway to the Pacific, because in the first half of the 19th century, the sea was how American mariners were making their way out into the world. It was, you know, the sea was much easier place to travel than overland. And American merchants and sea otter traders had made their way to the Oregon coast decades before Lewis and Clark. And so in many ways, the Lewis and Clark expedition was catching up with the achievements of its mariners. And so it's interesting to think that at this early stage, America was much more globally oriented in a way than it would later become.
Yeah. Now, prior to the XX, there had been several notable voyages of discovery, as you've just alluded to. Columbus, Magellan, Cook, the Chinese, as you pointed out, were great explorers of the seas. How was the exploring expedition of 1838, I almost said 1938, to be different from the expeditions that preceded it?
Yeah, well, you know, it was late in the game for global exploration. as you said, the Chinese, the Europeans had been sending out voyages for hundreds of years. And these European expeditions served often the empire in terms of finding colonies for these nations that were looking to expand their global reach. America, on the other hand, had more than enough unexplored territory in its own boundaries. In the first half of the 19th century, the last thing America wanted was a colony out there to take care of. But what America needed was to catch up with the achievements of its mariners, people like the Nantucket whalemen, sealers from Stonington, Connecticut, were venturing to places that not even James Cook and the dozens of European exploring expeditions that had followed him had ventured to. And as a consequence, they were sailing blind. They had no charts provided for them by any government. And so, for example, the Fiji group in 1838, there were no reliable charts. And American mariners going there were wrecking their ships on a frequent basis because it was so dangerous there, and it was becoming impossible to insure a vessel to go there. So there was this outcry among maritime communities up and down the coast that it was time finally for the U.S. government to launch its first ocean-going voyage of discovery to map these islands that the mariners had been really the first explorers to venture to in many cases.
Yeah, but also here underlying this is the interest in trade.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because in 1838, what you see is, you know, you expect the maritime communities to be pushing for this. But really the swing vote, so to speak, would be Ohio, which was the West at that time, because they were the grain-growing states, and they realized that they needed markets for what they were producing. And they realized that the way to identify those markets, for America to plant its flag in the world and establish the diplomatic relations that would allow this trade to happen, was with an exploring expedition. So you see, finally, the U.S. government taking up the challenge of sending out a voyage of discovery around the world.
Hmm. To what extent did the pursuit of scientific knowledge motivate these explorers?
It was really with Cook that that science became, it was the Enlightenment, you know, looking to identify a scientific approach to the world. That with Cook began by taking a scientist along, a group of scientists along, and this had become sort of the standard operation of these exploring expeditions. Usually it was two vessels with a small team of scientists, usually a naturalist or two, and heading out and collecting specimens and artifacts. And the USXX, as it was called, would be really an incredibly ambitious endeavor for a young republic with a navy that was less than half the size of Great Britain's to contemplate. They would, with six vessels, 346 men, they had seven scientists and two artists. This was before photography, so they needed artists to make drawings of the things they were seeing. And what made this especially amazing was that there was no real national science organization or museum in America. There just wasn't the institutional support that you'd find in European nations. So it would be the USXX that would really, almost single-handedly, reinvent science in America.
Mm. Now, the idea for an expedition, for this kind of expedition, goes back to the administration of John Quincy Adams, right?
Yeah, it was Adams who really he saw this need very early on, and called out for it. Not only an expedition, he said, we need a national university, we need a national observatory, all these things. But at that point, American people were just not ready to go for it. They were too busy building roads and canals and railroads and just expanding to think about it. But things would change as commerce and science began to move forward in America.
Yeah. So we have the USXX touching on the administrations of five presidents.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, and what is really the ironic thing is it would be the Andrew Jackson administration. And, you know, Jackson was initially an isolationist who sort of scoffed at the maritime New England communities as upper crust and out of touch with the people. But what Jackson appreciated was the need for America to right any actual or perceived wrongs around the globe. And And like it or not, by this point, America did have the beginnings of a global economy, and the Navy was the way to enforce to help out American ships when they ran into problems. And he also was, you know, he was fascinated with the concept of exploration, you know, a Westerner. And so what you see is sort of almost a backwoods ethic of exploration and a sort of a rambunctious need to show that we can do it out there. And you see Jackson being the president that oversees the beginning of a movement towards an exploring expedition.
Yeah. And then after it was all over, Congress becomes hugely enthusiastic about this kind of expedition.
Right, it does, and you know it's an about face because up until this point, Congress really didn't see any need for something as esoteric as a voyage of discovery in the name of science. You know, science, what good does that do anyone? And this would really force Congress's hand to make the beginnings of what would be incredible investments in science. Beginning with the U.S. exploring expedition in the decades prior to the Civil War, the budget, almost a third of the American budget would end up going for the cause of science, more than during the space race in the 20th century. And this was all brought into motion by the need for this exploring expedition.
Yeah. Well, in a moment here, we're going to get to Charles Wilkes and the role he played sort of in the XX and the success of the expedition, but yet also all the dark moments that came along with it. But here before we get to Charles Wilkes, I wonder if all the subsequent expeditions, the subsequent surveying, also helped obscure the impact of the exploring expedition.
Absolutely. You put your finger on a real what really happened in many ways. In a sense, the exploring expedition would be a victim of its own success because as far as the American people were concerned, one of the more interesting aspects of this expedition was the time it spent in the Pacific Northwest, because the Oregon Territory, San Francisco Bay, Puget Sound, all these were places where the American people would move out to en masse in the years after the expedition when it returned in 1842, especially with the discovery of gold in 48. And so these pioneers would read Wilkes's narrative, take his maps with them, and as they rushed west and subsequent exploring expeditions and mapping expeditions into the west took hold, like Fremont and others, that's where America's imagination would go, to the west, to the conquest and winning of the west. And America, in a very essential way, would turn its back on the oceans that had really defined it in the first half of the 19th century. And with that, there really would be no place in the American memory for Charles Wilkes and the U.S. exploring expedition. Mm.
It's interesting that you mention imagination, because I think there is a link here between science and art. On the edges of this story, we have writers, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe,
right.
Herman Melville?
Yeah. We don't know anything about this expedition today, but at the time it was an essential part of the culture and yes, the American imagination. Nathaniel Hawthorne wanted desperately to go on this expedition, to be the historiographer. Politics would get in the way and he couldn't go. Edgar Allan Poe was fascinated with what was down there at the bottom of the world. And one of the motivators of this expedition was a crackpot theory that there were holes in the poles, holes that led into the interior of the earth. And this theory would figure into several of Poe's stories and one of his novels, Arthur Gordon Pym. Melville was fascinated with the USXX. He would read Wilkes's narrative when he was working on Moby Dick, and some have said that Wilkes's search for the white continent of Antarctica was a model for Melville's portrayal of Ahab in the search for the white whale. You've got Thoreau in the last chapter of Walden. You know, that seems like, yes, it's a pond, but it seems a pretty land-bound book. But in the last chapter, he refers to the USXX and says, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it proves that a voyage around the world through icebergs and cannibals is as difficult as one man voyaging into his own soul. And then finally, there is Mark Twain, someone who we so associate with the West, who in his autobiography late in life would remember that when he was a boy of 10 in Hannibal, Missouri, and he heard that Wilkes had discovered Antarctica, he was just filled with excitement. He said how wonderful the glory. He said that Wilkes was another Columbus and had visited the dreamlands of the world. And so you see that, yes, there was at this time, this was fulfilling a real essential need of the American imagination.
So was the USS, U.S. Exploring Expedition the discoverer of the continent of Antarctica?
Not technically.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it's kind of, we say that Columbus discovered America, but, you know, Columbus went to the Caribbean and Bahamian Islands and said, this is the East Indies. I mean, he refused to say that this was a new world, and yet we call him the discoverer of America. Charles Wilkes was not the first to sight Antarctica, because as early as the 1820s, American and British sealers going down from Cape Horn had come across what we now know as the Antarctic Peninsula. At the time, it was generally assumed that it was a group of islands similar to the South Shetlands above it. But and in 1838, when Wilkes headed down, you know, no one really knew what was down there. Cook had sailed about 3 days below the Antarctic Circle, found nothing but snow and ice, and decided to turn back since he realized it was almost a suicidal endeavor to sail in those conditions. So what Wilkes did was he didn't discover technically Antarctica, but he was the first to chart a significant portion of the coastline, the first to provide compelling evidence that a huge landmass down there existed, and he would pronounce it the Antarctic continent.
That's the importance of his contribution there.
And I think it's really actually a much more difficult, I mean, it's one of the most heroic feats of seamanship that's out there. And in a very essential way, it's a lot tougher than discovery is to explore and survey and chart a coastline surrounded by icebergs.
Yeah. Now, you know, personally, I would have no interest in sailing with Charles Wilkes.
You and me both.
You know, we've talked about some of these achievements, but at the same time, many shortcomings here.
Yeah.
Who was he, and what was his background?
Well, you know, he was born to well-to-do parents in New York City. His mother died when he was 2, and just at 4 years old, he was sent away to boarding school. And his first memory was of clutching his father's leg at that school, saying, "Don't let me, you know, don't leave me, don't leave me." And for the rest of his life, he was motivated by this aching need for praise, for adulation, to make a mark on the world. And he was a most unusual naval officer. He was infatuated with the legacy of Cook and the uniform of a naval captain, and so he joined the Navy. But he was a really unusual naval officer. He, instead of spending his time at sea, he was more of a man of science. He spent the 5 years before the exploring expedition as head of the Depot of Charts and Instruments in Washington D.C., where he worked out of his home on Capitol Hill, not far from the nation's capital, built an observatory, and where he rated chronometers and sent out the charts to the various naval bases up and down the coast, and also worked on his political connections, which would serve him well when it came to maneuvering for this command. And so when he was finally given this command, he was given the command because it was a very controversial undertaking. The American Navy didn't know what to do with it. They would rather fight wars than lead a exploring expedition in the name of science. And after 2 years of controversy, Wilkes would get the command, sort of as a last straw effort. He was just a lieutenant, and he was given command of this huge expedition, but had very little sea experience. And so, yes, he could survey islands, but he did not have the experience or the temperament, really, to command people. And so he was a most unusual choice, and yet he would have all sorts of problems, suffer a breakdown just a few months into the voyage, reemerge as what he called the Martinet, someone who he had originally treated his officers as his friends. He now belittled, mocked them, it was the only mask of command, as has been said, that could really get the job done given the limitations of his personality.
Yeah.
And not surprisingly, his officers came to despise him, and yet he got it done.
Hmm. He probably shouldn't have chosen a career in the Navy. It was a matter of pride for him that he hang in.
Absolutely. He was, you know, this was something he was infatuated with as a young person. He went out on a merchant vessel for the first time as a teenager, and against the wishes of his father. His father thought he should have a career in banking, or he could have been a professor or something like that. But no, he wanted to go to sea, and so he went to sea and quickly found that it was no fun at all. He was aristocratic, and the seamen mocked him. The food was terrible, the conditions loathsome, and yet it was a matter of pride. He was not going to say to his father that you were right. And years later, long after the exploring expedition was done, as was his naval career, he wrote an autobiography, a fascinating document, just a huge book that is very self-serving and yet very revealing. And in that he says that his temperament was not necessarily suited for this calling. He was condescending, all these things. And yet given it was a matter of pride, and so he had gone ahead and done it, and so here he was.
Mm. You wonder why he, after that very first voyage, if he was going to continue with it, he wouldn't have said, well, if I am ever in command, I will be a much better, leader than who I have served for,
yeah.
who I've served and who I've served alongside. But that didn't happen.
No, it's the Greek said character is destiny. And I think Wilkes's character would determine what he would do over and over again, even though he knew better. He had this obsessive, fanatical personality. I think it's not wrong to compare him to Richard Nixon, who a man of, in some sense, extraordinary abilities, yet who could not control his own worst tendencies, whose paranoia and need to control would always wreck some. Some very incredible and sabotage some incredible accomplishments. This was Wilkes. He needed someone to rein him in. And when he was working at the Depot of Charts and Instruments, with his wife by his side, and he had a wonderful marriage. They were really companions in his work in the Navy when he was on land. And she scripted. Her name was Jane Renwick Wilkes, and she scripted many of the moves that won Wilkes command of the exploring expedition. Wilkes called her my moderation, because he would push and push and push. She would draw him back and keep him on a steady course. But once the expedition left the Norfolk Navy Yard in 1838, he, of course, could not take Jane with him. And what you see is the gradual breakdown of his psyche until he emerges as this raging martinet, and it's the only way he can hold it together.
Mm-hmm. Too bad she couldn't have been aboard the Vincennes.
Yeah, I mean, and there is a wonderful letter he writes to her in the weeks before the expedition leaves, and it's half kidding, in which he says, "Wouldn't it be great if you could be my second in command, and we could trick out our children in midshipmen's uniforms, and we would all go out together around the world?" And it was a fantasy for Wilkes, and I've always wondered, if he could have done that, it might have been a very different voyage.
Mm. Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Sea of Glory, America's Voyage of Discovery, the U.S. Exploring Expedition, 1838 to 1842. We have a listener waiting to talk with us, a caller in Urbana, line one. Go ahead.
Thank you. Can you connect this expedition to the opening of Japan, and could you also tell us, if you haven't already and I missed it, who was president at the time of the expedition and the type of ships, such as frigates or barks or barkentines or whatever, in this little group?
Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, the administration that finally launched the expedition was the Van Buren administration. Van Buren was Jackson's hand-picked successor. So it was a Jacksonian Democratic administration when the voyage headed out. there were six vessels, two of them sloops of war, the Peacock and the flagship Vincennes. There was a brig, the Porpoise, a smaller vessel, about 88 feet, just a few years old, the storeship Relief, which had been specifically built for this exploring expedition, was heavily reinforced. And my two favorite vessels on this expedition were two schooners, the Flying Fish and Seagull, just 70 feet long. They had been New York pilot boats before they became exploring vessels. And so it was a real hodgepodge. And the Relief, oddly enough, which had been built specifically for this purpose, would prove completely inadequate. It was over-timbered, slow, and mean to handle, and Wilkes would be forced to send it back just a year into the expedition, along with all the officers he didn't like, by the way. And the expedition would go around the world, cover 87,000 miles, and you asked about its relation to Perry and the opening up of Japan. Well, you know, this was originally going to be a three-year voyage. It would expand to 4 years because it was just overly ambitious where they wanted Wilkes to go. And in the initial instructions from the Secretary of Navy, they were to try to visit Japan. They just didn't have time to do it because after they ventured to the Pacific Northwest, it's interesting. They 3 years into it, they were in San Francisco Bay, and yet in the real sense, they were about as far away from returning home as possible because they went the long way. They went to the Philippines, to Singapore, around Cape Town, and all the way back. And they didn't have time to go to Japan. And given the difficulty Perry had, it probably would have been a waste of time, given time constraints. But it was in the exploratory air, so to speak. It was an area that people were interested in. And it would, of course, be left to Perry for that chapter of exploration.
Yeah, an amazing amount of territory they covered. 87,000 miles.
Yeah, extraordinary. And, you know, there were six vessels originally. They would lose two of them. The schooner Seagull would be sunk in a storm off Cape Horn. The Peacock, 118-foot sloop of war, would be wrecked on the bar at the Columbia River, pounded to pieces in the waves, forcing the men to abandon it in boats. And although they would get as much as they could off it, thousands of specimens were lost. And more than 40 people would die during this expedition. But given where the amount of places they went to, the mountain of men involved, it was really, Wilkes was quite good in protecting the health of his men, even though he could not be described as a kind commander.
Yeah. The officers of the expedition kept journals, and these were to be surrendered at the end of the voyage to the commander. But
there was a young past midshipman, and this was pre the Naval Academy in Annapolis, and so if you were what we would call an ensign, you were called a past midshipman, ready to be made a lieutenant. There was a 22-year-old past midshipman named William Reynolds from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who for his 6 years of his Navy career so far had kept a personal journal, which he would share with his family back in Lancaster. And when Wilkes ordered that his officers begin to keep journals, Reynolds could not bear the thought of turning over his private journal. So he began to keep an official journal, essentially a dummy journal for Wilkes, while keeping his personal journal, which would grow to 250,000 words. And it is just an incredible document. Reynolds was a wonderful writer, articulate, sensitive, knowledgeable, and this journal, which is at Franklin Marshall College, really tells the untold story of the USXX, how a group of officers who began the voyage essentially worshiping Wilkes, because Wilkes was the one who brought this expedition together when it looked like it might never leave America, only to come to despise Wilkes as he turned into the martinet. And it's all in this journal. And it also is a coming-of-age story because, you know, he was a 22-year-old kid when they left Norfolk in 1838, and he comes of age amid the icebergs of the Antarctic, of the giant trees of the Pacific Northwest, and the coral of the Pacific, and I really think his prose, when it comes to writing about the sea, ranks with any American operating in the 19th century. I'd put him right up there with Dana and Melville.
Has it been published?
It will be. I am editing a copy of it with my father, Thomas Philbrick, who is a retired English professor and book editor. And we are coming out with an edition of William Reynolds' journal to be published in about a year from now.
Mm. And tell us, too, about 20 years before the mast.
Yes. Well, and this is the other great source that helped me in writing this book. There was a young seaman named Charlie Erskine, who at 16, even before the expedition began, was whipped by Wilkes during a brief survey of George's Bank off Cape Cod. And young Charlie had looked to Wilkes as a kind of father figure, but immediately despised him soon after the whipping, which was he was whipped for taking time off to visit his mother in Boston, and he just didn't think that was right. And Charlie was illiterate when the expedition began, because against his will he was assigned to the Vincennes. He would be able to put his emotions for Wilkes behind him. But during this expedition, he would learn to read and write. And once the squadron reached Hawaii, he would write his first letter home. And late in life, in 1890, long after Wilkes and Reynolds and just about everyone associated with the expedition had died, Charlie would publish a book, 20 years before the mast, about his time in the USXX. And it's completely different from any other account, because it comes from a sailor, not an officer who was in charge and leading the expedition, but a sailor who actually did all the work. And when combined with Reynolds and Wilkes's accounts, it really helps to provide a balanced view of what happened during this expedition.
Yeah. Did In the Heart of the Sea, that book that you wrote just a couple of years ago, that congratulations won the National Book Award, did that book lead you to this story?
Yes, it did. In a great sense, this is almost In the Heart of the Sea part two in one sense. Well, at the end of In the Heart of the Sea, Captain Pollard, the captain of the ill-fated Essex that gets rammed and sunk by a whale, after surviving horrible ordeal, heads out once again, and in the ship, two brothers. And he rounds the horn and is off the coast of Peru when he comes across a naval schooner called the Water Witch that's associated with the newly established Pacific Station of the U.S. Navy. And aboard this schooner is a young 24-year-old midshipman who's just read about the Essex disaster. And he says, "You're not the same Captain Pollard, are you?" And Pollard says, "Yes, I am." And the young midshipman says, "Well, how could you go out again?" And Pollard says, "Well, you know, there's a saying, the lightning never strikes in the same place twice." But for Pollard it would. He would wreck the two brothers a few months later on an uncharted shoal off Hawaii. Well, that young midshipman who asked Pollard these questions was Charles Wilkes, who 15 years later would lead America's first expedition to chart the very hazards that had finished Pollard's career and the careers of hundreds of American mariners. And so it in a very essential way, led me to this book, Sea of Glory.
Mm. What was the most difficult ordeal the exploring expedition confronted?
You know, they went through all sorts of tough times. And you know, in one sense, the time in the ice was physically the most punishing, because particularly aboard the Vincennes, which would spend more than a month dodging icebergs as it worked its way west along the Antarctic coast. They would weather three different gales, gales that would force them to run before the wind, dodging icebergs all the way. The officers came to Wilkes and said that so many men were benumbed by cold and dazed with exhaustion that they were to the point where it was difficult to manage the ship. Wilkes said, "We're going to continue on," because he knew the farther they went, the more of a opportunity he would have to claim that it was indeed a continent. And so that was just completely punishing in a physical sense. But I think the psychic torture of this endeavor. I mean, there's all sorts of elements. We're so into communication these days, you know, with cell phones and stuff. Wilkes didn't get a single letter from home until 2 years into the voyage when they arrived in Hawaii. You know, these are difficult things to deal with, and but it would be in Fiji where Wilkes would, where the men would really have the toughest time, because they would be in small boats surveying these coral-fringed, razor-sharp islands. The natives had a well-deserved reputation for violence and cannibalism. And but towards the end of it, they were the men were running out of food and needed to barter with the natives for some hogs, just something to eat. And two of Wilkes's officers would end up in a skirmish with the natives and would have their brains bashed out on the beach. And one of these officers was Wilkes's 19-year-old midshipman nephew, Wilkes Henry, who had basically become a son to him, the eldest son of his widowed sister. And it was impossible for Wilkes not to take this loss very personally. And as you alluded to earlier, he would respond by massacring the village that he felt was responsible for this.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Eureka, line 4. Hello.
Hi. A very fascinating description. You said that this voyage was 4 years and covered 87,000 miles?
Yes.
Could you give maybe like a brief description of the places it went? That's like, what, 3.5 times around the world?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they began in Norfolk, Virginia, went to Madeira off the coast of northern Africa. Chris went back and forth along the Atlantic as they worked their way south, looking for rumored shoals and even an island that didn't exist, because a lot of exploring is negative. It's finding what isn't there. Mm-hmm. They made their way down to Cape Horn, made their first stab south there, and ventured down to the Antarctic Peninsula, worked their way up to Peru, and headed out to the Pacific, making their way to Tahiti, to Samoa, eventually getting all the way to Sydney, Australia, where they dived down south, and that's when Wilkes would chart what's now called Wilkes Land. And then it was up to the Fiji Islands, where they would lose two officers, on to then the Hawaiian Islands, during which their time there, Wilkes would climb to the top of Mauna Loa, 14,000 feet high, and conduct pendulum experiments in the midst of a hurricane.
Oh, my goodness.
While that was happening, two of his ships, the Peacock and the schooner Flying Fish, were circling the central Pacific, charting islands there, you know, and creating charts that we would be using during World War II when we were fighting the Japanese. After that, they would all meet up at the Columbia River, where they surveyed a 100-mile stretch of the Columbia River all the way up to Fort Vancouver, near where Portland is now. They would chart Puget Sound. Bainbridge Island, off modern-day Seattle, was named by Wilkes. Elliott Bay, the location of Seattle, was named for Midshipman Samuel Elliott of the U.S. Exploring Expedition. They would then go down to San Francisco Bay, meet up with an overland expedition that had made its way down the Sacramento River, chart that, and then it was back to America after hitting the Philippines, Singapore, Cape Town, and then finally...
So they went west. They went west, all the way west.
Right, more than 22,000 miles for their last...
Around the south end of Africa.
Yeah, yeah. So... These guys went everywhere, and it's, you know, it's a time when voyage exploring was not cowboy and Indians, but Star Trek.
Yes, yes.
Where you were going to different worlds, and you weren't in search of, you weren't trying, it wasn't conquest that was motivating these guys. They were in search of essential knowledge, and I think, you know, this is an expedition that I think we can learn from today in terms of how America operates in the world stage.
From the, you said from Australia they went to Wilkes Land. That's back down around Antarctica, isn't it?
That's right. They sailed directly south, you know, directly south, right into the ice, sighted land, and then turned right, headed west, and sighting land all the way. And Wilkes would create a detailed chart that, you know, it's very hard to judge distances down there because there's no humidity in the air. And so that what looks 20 miles away can be 80 miles away. And so Wilkes' chart would beat to modern standards unreliable because he misjudged those distances, as would have anyone at that time. And British explorers, particularly James Ross, would later deride the accuracy and say that he never even saw a continent. But it wouldn't be until the 1950s when an Australian photo reconnaissance expedition went down there that they verified that, you know, Wilkes' chart was actually amazingly accurate given the technology of the day.
And he had gone there the first time when he went down on the south coast of South America to the Palmer Peninsula, right?
That's right. That's right. And they were very late at that time. They had so much they had to do to get down there that it was already late February when they left Cape Horn, which is really the time you should be coming back from Antarctica. But they went down there just the same, and Wilkes would make it just to the tip of Palmer Land or the Antarctic Peninsula, while the little schooner Flying Fish would work its way farther south than anyone, and in many ways that is one of the ultimate voyages of this expedition.
And thank you, fascinating description.
Yeah,
thanks for the call this afternoon. We're coming down on the end of the time that we can spend together today. I have a couple questions left. Was there ever any danger of mutiny?
Yes. Wilkes, in fact, began to sense, once they were in the Pacific and relations were really getting bad between himself and his officers, he was beginning to sense that even one of the scientists, a guy named Joseph Kathui, a conchologist, someone who collects mollusks and shells and things like that, Kathui was a temperamental sort, much like Wilkes, and he was in addition to being a scientist, was an experienced seaman, and he just could not stand the way Wilkes was conducting this expedition. And he began to talk with some of the officers, saying that it was time that someone seize control of this expedition and conduct it correctly. Wilkes heard about this and confronted him, and called him on it and said if he did any of this rabble-rousing again, he would leave him on a deserted island and never to return. And Kathui would eventually leave the expedition, and Wilkes would continue on in control, and yet it would still be open warfare between himself and his men.
Mm. Well, you mentioned this scientific seaman, which brings me to my last question this afternoon. This expedition collected so many specimens, so many artifacts. There were drawings made and whatnot. And there's a description in the book Sea of Glory of these ships loaded to the, you know, loaded, you know, every which way with specimens and artifacts, which reminded me of my favorite character from Patrick O'Brien's books, Dr. Stephen Maturin. Once they got back, what became of the specimens, the artifacts? How much work was involved then in terms of cataloging these things, and what became of the collection?
Yeah, for many of the scientists, it would become a lifelong endeavor dealing with the collections and the stuff and the information they had brought back. And Wilkes would actually dedicate his life to overseeing the publication of the scientific results. They would also these would be the first significant scientific publications of the U.S. government. And even more important, the Smithsonian Institution would be founded in large part to house the stuff, brought the 40 tons of artifacts brought back by the exploring expedition. And in many ways, that is one of the more significant legacies of this expedition. The U.S. Botanic Garden, which is now there at the base of Capitol Hill, was founded with specimens brought back by the USXX. The Naval Observatory is a direct descendant of Wilkes's activities. And so prior to this expedition, science was practiced by amateurs in America. After this expedition, science was becoming professionalized, and the government was realizing that it was up to them to pay for this science if America was going to move forward as a nation.
Mm. Well, Nathaniel, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, and I look forward to reading William Reynolds' books.
Well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Nathaniel Philbrick has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Sea of Glory. He is also the author of In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award. And by the way, Sea of Glory, the publisher, Viking. And that interview was from November 18th of 2003. So Nathaniel Philbrick's latest book is Mayflower. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago on the Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was an interesting day in Kansas City as well as at the Chicago Board of Trade and Minneapolis as well, for that matter, as wheat prices managed to claw their way back from prices that were in the red this morning, finishing in the green and pretty much separating themselves from what was going on in the corn pit and in the soybean pit, where except for a few nearby corn contracts, a lot of red on the screen in both corn and soybeans today. Let's look at some particulars. We'll start in Kansas City, where December wheat The December wheat contract, it looks to me like it did not have a trade today. But the March wheat contract, a high on the day of 542.5, a low of 531. It was settled at 541.5, up 5.5. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high price on the day of 491. A low of 480, settling 490.5, up 3.25. March, a high of 513, a low of $5, settling 511.5, up 3.5. May, a high of 516, a low of 506, settling 516, up 3.5. July, a high of 495, a low of 484, settling 494, up 2. September, a high of 498, a low of 487, settling 495, up 5 on the day. December corn, a high of 371, a low of 361.5, settling 370.25, up 1.5. March, a high of 386, a low of 377, settling 385.25, up 0.5. May, a high of 390.5, a low of 382.25, settling 390, down 3/4. July, a high of 394, a low of 386, settling 393.25, down 1.25. September, a high of 372, a low of 365.5, settling 372, down 3/4. December, the red line, a high of 361.25, a low of 355, settling 360.75, down 2. March, a high of 367.5, a low of 360, settling 367.25, unchanged. The May 2008, a high of 371.5, a low of 363, settling 371.25, up 2.25. December oats, a high of 252.25, a low of 246.5, settling 250, down 5.5. March, a high of 264.5, a low of 250.